So when it comes to sitting down one-on-one with someone in an interview process, you learn a lot about them by asking off the cuff, off the beaten path questions. What's your favorite dad joke? How did you mess up and what's funny about it in hindsight? You can weed out the people that are putting on a facade versus somebody who's authentic in an interview process by asking them those questions.
I'm Dan Smullen, and this is the Dan Smullen Podcast. We help people to navigate the future of work, to work that is profound, protects the planet, empowers people and communities, and is fun to do, meaningful work. The stories that our guests tell and the insights that they provide will inspire you to connect with work and experiences that stoke your passions and make the world a better place. For the future of work is meaningful work. The mission of the Dan Smullen Experience is to help people find success and enjoyment in the work that they do and hope to do. We believe there are four career journey components that get people to blissful work and career experiences, and they are dream, explore, strategize, and act. First, we encourage people of all ages, backgrounds, and levels of education and training to dream about the kind of work that they believe will make them happy and well-purposed. Next, we guide them to explore opportunities to do the work that they dream about. Then we focus them to strategize, to align with the skill and experience needed to do the work and opportunities of their choosing. And last, we prod them to act, to seize on the opportunities to do the work of their dreams. We believe the key to success is intentionality, allowing dreams, explorations, strategies, and actions to happen fluidly. To be truly successful in the future of work, we must be career intentional about dreaming, exploring, strategizing, and acting throughout our lives. You can find useful and actionable podcast episodes and blog posts on dansmullen.com. Use the spyglass to search for content to dream, explore, strategize, and act. And when on the site, make sure you sign up for our free newsletter. Just click the newsletter tab on the top of our webpage, then click subscribe, and you will be on your way. In a dynamic future of work, agility is key, and our ever-changing dreams can help us align with future success. Is the future of work funny? Well, that's the question that's been on my mind as millions of us try to make sense of the absurdity around where, when, and how professional work will be done. To answer this question and others, we turned to David Horning. David is a stand-up comedian who, through his brand Water Cooler Comedy, helps forward-thinking organizations build strong workplace cultures through humor. We cover a lot of ground in this episode, including how David engages organizations to improve their cultures, the challenges of expressing humor in the workplace, the comedians who influenced his life and work, and his answer to the question, is the future of work funny? I spoke with David Horning in August 2021 over Zoom. David Horning, welcome to the podcast.
Dan, I acknowledge you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate this opportunity.
Duly noted, my brother. Hey, before we get started, wondering if you could tell me and tell the audience about Water Cooler Comedy. What is that and what's your mission in doing it?
Well, I work with managers who want to engage and connect their teams so that they can attract and keep employees who want to be there. And I do so through the use of humor, which is a very human condition. So basically, I teach managers to stop taking themselves so seriously so that they can open themselves up to building connections with their teams so that they can, you know, have fun at work, so that they can attract and keep some of the best people. And using a sense of humor kind of humanizes us. And Water Cooler Comedy is a company that I started initially to do like corporate comedy events. You know, I book comedians, I bring them in, you know, you tell me what you're looking for as far as the vibe of the event, the type of people that are going to be there. I'll link up with local comics, figure out who's going to be a great fit. And then we turn your workplace into a comedy club. But when COVID happened, I realized that, oh, I need to teach people how to use this skill, because it is a skill, which means it can be developed. And so I put together some webinars, I put together a 90-day program, and I put together an 8-week course as well throughout this past year, focusing on developing the use of humor in leaders.
I really want to dig into Water Cooler Comedy, but I got to start with your origin story. How and when did you discover that you had the gift of making others laugh?
I was a kid. I was real little. And it wasn't just that I made all my classmates laugh. I made it my goal to make my teachers laugh. Because if I could make adults laugh, then I couldn't get in trouble for being the class clown, right? If they're laughing, they can't yell at me. And so, I mean, they did, which was fun. But that experience of just making people feel good and taking something as boring as going to school and being able to inject my personality into it, and figuring out the timing of it and learning when's the right place to use humor, when's not the right place to use humor. And when it isn't the right place to use humor, how can I do something similar? And that's always been a fun game for me. And, you know, I went to school for political science because I've always wanted to make a difference in people's lives. And I thought that was the way to do it. So I've always had an inherent interest in politics. And that it was a really disheartening experience because I learned that politics are about politics and not about people. It's about winning and not helping people. And that was really kind of a shock to my system. And just at that moment of realization, I lost a close family member. Mm-hmm. And at the funeral, I helped my family get through it through using my sense of humor. And that's when I realized, okay, this is what I need to do. This is how I'm going to help people. And I've been fighting the uphill battle ever since.
You know, it's really interesting that you discovered that you could get your family members through probably the worst experience of their lives through humor. My late father-in-law was a funeral director, and he was the funniest guy on the planet. Funeral directors are enmeshed in absurdity.
Yep.
And gosh, when things go horribly wrong in the funeral business, it's bad, but it's often very funny.
It is, yeah. Yes.
So your work benefits working people and companies. And I want to know, what does comedy do to positively impact and improve the workplace experience that they have?
It creates a narrative shift, first and foremost. If you're laughing together with your coworkers, it creates instant connection. If you laugh with somebody that you didn't necessarily care for, all of a sudden in the back of your mind, you might not be thinking it consciously, oh, this person's all right. It's that instant trust that really brings us together through humor. And that's where I found the value in this. And especially working as a comedian, being able to make a point on stage and get people to laugh at something that they don't necessarily agree with, that means I've opened the door just a crack so that they can see that maybe their position isn't the only position. And just allowing people to see beyond themselves in that moment. That's the value of humor that I want to unlock in people, because we get so married to our positions. We don't want to be wrong, but we don't have all the answers. And so being able to laugh at that kind of opens us up to connecting with other people and to connecting with a deeper sense of ourselves and connecting ourselves with new ideas.
You know, I spent 20 years in recruiting. I was a headhunter. And among the biggest motivations that you see in successful people is money and recognition. Mm. And the recognition part used to be very singular. How am I recognized, as opposed to the new narrative, which is, how can we all be recognized? How can I recognize you? How can you recognize me? But how can we all be recognized and recognized each other? So how do you get somebody past the point of being so selfish that they can't get beyond their own thought processes in a group dynamic at work?
Well, I can't go into it as saying, I'm going to come in here and I'm going to change your mind. It's got to be an organic process. I look at it from the point of view that we all, like our common ground, we all want to have a positive experience. We all want to have a good day. We all want to go home feeling better than we did when we got wherever it is. And so just starting from that point and working backwards, I think is important because you're dealing with a diverse cast of characters. If I walk into a room and I think I'm going to change your mind today, I've already lost because I'm not focusing on the right thing. What I need to focus on first and foremost is making that connection and then developing that rapport and trust. And then we can get them thinking outside of themselves a little bit. Then we can start the process of a change in perspective, because if they don't like me, nothing I say is going to matter. So I can't walk in thinking I'm going to make you like me. I have to authentically be curious about where they are, ask questions, meet them where they are. In a podcast standpoint, you know, your job as a host is to ask questions. You immediately make yourself endearing to me because now I'm talking about myself. It's the same sort of thing when you walk into a relationship, a professional relationship. If I'm sitting down with a manager and they want to figure out how to get people to want to stay with them, I'm not going to walk in and be like, well, you're doing things wrong, because immediately they're not going to like me. I'm going to ask questions about what they've been doing, what's worked well, what their biggest wins have been, and then start working towards that moment of realization. But until I make that connection, there's going to be no breakthrough.
So what's the breakthrough come from? Is it a recognition of absurdity?
In some cases, yeah. In some cases, we all behave absurdly, and then we try to rationalize it in hindsight. And that, to me, that's comedy right there. It's built into every single experience we have. Every single thing we say and we do is rooted in being irrational and then rationalizing it in hindsight, which that's such a fun playground for me. But the moment of realization for them, it can come in a lot of different forms. It depends on the person, of course, but when it comes to using humor, everybody has a subjective process. So maybe it's laughing at something. The trick that I like to use is to get them to recall stories from when they were younger. That moment that now you can look back at it and laugh. What sort of behaviors did you do then that you're still doing today was something that is totally unlike that experience. So as a kid, we try to be cool. You know, we want to be like, we don't know who we are yet. And we're going through this experience. We're still going through that experience. And so to kind of draw a parallel between those two things, if you can laugh at something that you did in hindsight that you've laughed about for a while now, and then apply that same perspective to something that you're currently dealing with or more recently dealing with, that's when the light bulb will flick on.
So how does that work with a high-flying executive? And I know you deal with these folks, you know, they have spent their days and their waking hours crafting every little nuance of their narrative, and they want to be perfect and they want to be perceived as perfect. And none of us are. We all come from the shared experience of failure. Yep. And that failure and that embarrassment is a constant reminder of where we come from. So how do you get somebody who's so image conscious, you know, they feel like, you know, they have to look like they walk on water to the headcount that they manage. Mm-hmm. How do you get that person to drop their drawers metaphorically?
It's asking questions.
Yeah.
And then it's perpetual curiosity. Yesterday I was watching Ted Lasso, which is a lighthearted comedy. So if you're looking for a little palate cleanser, Jeff, definitely check out Ted Lasso. It's a great show. But he mentioned something to one of the antagonists of the show. He said, and I'm paraphrasing and I'm probably going to butcher it, but essentially most people go through life making judgments. I learned to be curious, because when you're curious, you learn things about other people that throw those judgments out the window. And that, I'm paraphrasing big time. That's not nearly what he said, but it was that idea that the more you ask questions, the more you learn. It's so hard for me sometimes to not make judgments based off of what people tell me when I'm in a conversation with them, especially like leader executives. I can see where your holes are in recruiting. I can see where your holes are in culture. Oh, you made this big sweeping decision and you didn't get feedback from anybody? I could sit here and pontificate at you. We're not going to get to a breakthrough. I need to ask you questions to figure out what your mindset was. to get there, and then keep asking you questions so that you start to see these gaps in your own knowledge. And then that opens them up to suggestion more than just me saying, here's what you did wrong and here's what you need to do better. Nobody wins there.
So let's talk about that. And I am completely off the script now because I'm thinking about what it was like for me to deal with monolithic hiring managers who would say, Dan, this is like central casting, go find me somebody who looks like this. And oh, by the way, went to an Ivy League school, because going to an Ivy League school, right? That's what they wanted, right?
Right.
And that's top-down thinking. I know what's best for this organization. And I think the new way is to flip that and say, let's let ideation bubble up. Mm-hmm. So how does comedy help the recruiting process by leveling out all that bad juju? How do we get people to respect one another's humanity and recognize, you know what, they've got a different experience, but you know, they're really darn good at what they do. Mm-hmm. And let's find more like them mm-hmm. to join our little group here, which will get bigger and bigger and more successful. What are your thoughts?
I think it's a long-term process. Where I'm coming from, especially in today's recruiting environment, is that most organizations put culture building and employee engagement on the back burner because short-term, it has no impact on short-term results. We got to make sure the shareholders are happy. We got to make sure we hit these metrics by these dates. And there's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely not. Focus on that, sure. But to put culture on the back burner, now we are seeing the outcome of that. You could have spent the last 20 plus years building a place that is notorious for being a great place to work, a place where people care about one another, a place for where people go to bat for one another, a place where when things go wrong, we band together rather than point fingers. But instead, we're focusing on the bottom line and missing out on those deeply human interactions. So when it comes to recruiting, like my 101, when people are interested in my recruiting-based programs, I'm not an expert on recruiting and retention. I am an expert on culture. So when people come into that, that's what I'm focusing on. This isn't a magic bullet thing. This is a process, a continuous process that will never end, that needs to be just as important as hitting those bottom lines. So when it comes to sitting down one-on-one with someone in an interview process, you learn a lot about them by asking off the cuff, off the beaten path questions. Right. What's your favorite dad joke? How did you mess up and what's funny about it in hindsight? You can weed out the people that are putting on a facade versus somebody who's authentic in an interview process by asking them those questions.
Well, yes. And I would ask about situational dynamics for my clients. You know, I would ask them first, okay, you obviously have an 8-alarm fire going on here. So I need to know the kinds of things that you deal with on a day-to-day basis. Right. And let's throw the candidate in the deep end and see how they respond to swimming to shore. Mm-hmm. That you got to do. If you're running a crisis clinic, you've got to know that they're going to thrive.
Yep.
But you just don't want to do that. You want to find out about their humanity. And I think the interesting questions about, tell me about an absurdity that happened to you. I don't care what it is, but tell me something that just made you laugh. And then you'll find out whether or not they are warm-hearted or cruel. Mm-hmm. What made me laugh is I saw a guy trip on the subway. Well, you're a cold-hearted bastard.
Did you help him up at least?
Did you help him up? Or was there some absurdity that happened and you just found joy in it? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important from a cultural standpoint. And I think a lot of hiring managers miss that. Now, a trend that I saw a few years before I ended my own recruiting career, I think helps all of this. And what people are trying to do now is not hire when they need people, but be aware of people out there who could be a great addition to the culture. I don't mean a fit to the culture, but an addition to the culture, meaning change it in a positive way, enrich it, right? Mm-hmm. So you bring Dan in to have coffee. And you do all that fun stuff that David is talking about. You know, you make them laugh, you find out where their silly point is, and you find out about their humanity to find out what would this person be like in this culture? How would they change it in a wonderful way? And then you get an idea of what they can do for you. And then when an opening pops up, you already have somebody in the pipeline that you can draw in. The old way of recruiting that I used to do was demand structured. I need the person now. I don't know who that person is. The new way of doing it enriches culture. My old way of doing it is a roll of the dice.
Right.
You know, can they do the job? Yes. Do they really want to do the job? Will they enjoy doing the job? Yes. Are they a fit to the culture? I won't know for 90 days or more.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a story that I've heard. Before I speak to groups, I do a pre-event survey. And one of the questions is, what's something that isn't funny that has happened to you at work that is actually funny? And one of the responses that I use now is, this woman had her boss asked her, you know, we got to fill in these gaps. We've got these empty positions, fill them as fast as possible. We need warm bodies in there. And then when there wasn't a cultural fit, the boss called her into the office and said, why didn't you do better vetting on this person? you were demanding speed. I gave you speed. And now you want me to tell me what you want. And so it's just like, yeah, you have to be preemptive about it. You have to be proactive about it. And that's part of building a culture. Culture is a living thing. It's always evolving. It's always dynamic. And to say, no, this is our culture and that's final, while the intent is probably good, it's very limiting.
And that is why I think the work that you're doing is so important, because at the end of the day, we all want to at least get along. Mm-hmm. We may be diametrically opposed on a lot of different cultural fronts, but I know I can trust David. I know his heart, and I know I can get through the day with him, and I know we will find a way to solve this problem, this problem, this problem, and this problem, and make the client happy. That's what recruiting really should be about now. It really should be about a humanity first type of approach, because at the end of the day, a company's most important asset is people.
100%. Are you familiar with Menlo Innovations?
Probably, but not from the term.
Okay, so
what is it?
It's a software company, and Rich Sheridan is the CEO. He's known as the Chief Joy Officer. That's his message in his workplace. He's built a top culture. It brings people in from all over the world to just kind of walk into the workplace, get a feel for what it's like to work at Menlo Innovations. And a big part of that is the interview process. In an interview, you have two candidates. They sit at the same table and they're sharing a pencil and a piece of paper. How well do they work together to solve the problems posed by the interviewer? That's mm-hmm. how they judge fit, not mm-hmm. what your skills are, not where you came from. How do you work well with the person next to you? Because that's how they work. I mean, there's no cubicles, there's no offices. Everybody's working side by side. People are sharing computers and working together in a side by side dynamic. And that might not be for everybody. And that's where the interview process comes into play.
I think that's really important. I think we need to be doing more of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're basically torture testing a relationship.
Yeah, you don't have to be best friends. You can disagree on everything, but as long as you find that commonality and work together to move closer to that, that's more important than, like you said, it's, you know, you don't have to be best friends at the end of the day.
Yeah, and a lot of workplaces are full of people aware of each other's political bent and mm-hmm. philosophical bent, and that is now getting in the way of a lot of progress. Mm-hmm. And we have to find a way to kind of overcome that, because if you don't, companies won't survive. Their best people will leave. They'll run with their hair on fire to get out of the building.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. We were talking a little bit before we started recording. I spent the day yesterday with my parents. We don't agree. We don't see eye to eye politically. And even when, you know, my mom she's so good at poking the bear. She knows, you know, what pushes my buttons. But I've learned over the last couple months that nothing I say is going to convince her otherwise. It's wasted energy. Let's talk about how good her stuffed shells are instead. Our goal here, if we're looking at this from a professional relationship, is to leave our exchange, both of us feeling better than we were when we got here. So let's focus on that. We're not going to have a disagreement over something when I know I'm not going to get through to you. And I'm not going to sit here and grill you and ask you questions to get you to question your own beliefs. If you want to believe what you believe, that's fine. Just don't hurt anybody.
Well, that's a perfect segue to my next question, which has to do with the hardness of comedy. And and made me think of an event that I went to, oh, almost 20 years ago. It was a roast for a former boss of mine, and it was at a summer camp. And so somebody had the brilliant idea to do a comedy roast. And so the roast got really ugly. And I'm not going to get into the details of it, but it crossed every area that you should never cross. Sexuality. This is a summer camp. So, you know, you can just imagine where a comedian can go with something like this. Well, the roastee, my former boss, was so angry at the end because he felt that these people had besmirched the good reputations of his friends and campers and stuff like that. How do you make comedy work in a way that doesn't hurt people? How do you get it? I mean, I'm of a certain age. I turned 60 this year. I grew up listening to shock jocks and comics that did ethnic jokes. I don't think that stuff's funny anymore, but that was normal back when I was a teenager. How do we get to a better place so that the comedy is joyful? And how do you turn people around so that they recognize, dude, this isn't going to work. This is going to blow up in your face. Don't go there.
It's a process, just like everything else. So first of all, did they hire comics for that roast, or was it like employees that were writing the jokes?
Former employees that had professional careers, some of whom had done stand-up comedy.
Okay.
So they were good at what they did. Their timing was spot on. Their delivery was really good. And their content was painful. I'll just leave it at that. Mm-hmm.
So let me clarify your question. Is this about like stand-up comedy? You go to a comedy club, comedian gets on the stage and has a bit about a sensitive topic, or are we talking more in the workplace?
I'm talking more in the workplace. You know, you and I talked about a program I'm familiar with that trains veterans who have been in war and their families to learn stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. That stuff is raw, but it never gets sexual. They have ground rules. Don't talk about a person's sexuality. Don't talk about topics that are taboo. Talk about the weirdness of war. Talk about, I mean, if you want to talk about the fact that you're now hooked on painkillers because you got seriously injured in Iraq and now, you know, you've had limbs severed and you're in pain and you've been hooked on hydrocodone, that's okay. That's your experience. But don't talk about sexuality. Don't talk about, you know, the neighbor's 17-year-old kid, you know, that type of stuff, because we now have new rules of what's appropriate.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's about their experience. Mm-hmm. An audience can't deny your experience. Now, there are details. Again, you have to know, again, the ground rules. What's your culture like? Is your culture is your culture a place where people throw like offensive jokes back and forth and people laugh and it just rolls off their back? That's one thing. But if you even have to ask the question, is this going to go over well? Probably skip it, because you're not a professional comic. Chances are good, if you've got a day job, you're not a professional comic. And a lot of what you see in some of these comedy specials, especially the more sensitive jokes, the sensitive premises, that's years and years and years of getting it wrong in front of audiences that are more forgiving than your HR department. Your personal experience is huge. When you joke, the goal should be, again, and I'm going to keep coming back to this, is this going to make their day better? Are they going to leave the exchange feeling better or not? If there's even a question, table it, you know, save it for later.
Right.
But is this a personal experience? Because people can't deny that. What is the intent? Is the intent to uplift or to tear down? Is the intent to break down barriers or to build barriers? Is the intent to manipulate or to connect? So intent is everything. And then again, it's communication. A lot of comedy is communication. So if I say something that I think is innocuous, but it hurts somebody else, it's not my place to say whether or not that person should have been offended. I don't know what they've gone through. I don't know their experience. So when somebody comes to me and says, I didn't appreciate what you said, I have questions like, okay, how can we make this better next time? What did I do? Where did I cross the line? I want to avoid that next time. And so now I know where my boundaries are. When working within boundaries, you can be as creative as you want, but you know where those guardrails are. Whereas not having guardrails opens the door for a lot of mistakes.
And lawsuits.
And lawsuits. Exactly. Yeah. And so when I say humor in the workplace, I get that kind of that leaning back in the seat. Like, what is he, where is he going to go with this? And when I did that conference live, one of the questions that I asked the audience is, what do you think of when you think of humor in the workplace? And that was the first thing somebody said. It was lawsuits. And okay, cool. Let's break down that stigma, because humor in the workplace isn't about telling the best joke. It's about building stronger connection. And so if you're offending people, you're betraying the real positive outcome that comes from using humor in the workplace. And that is building connections. That is a deeper understanding of one another.
So many, many years ago, before my recruiting career, I was in the advertising agency space, and I worked for a company that was pretty formidable. We had really big clients. We had like Pepsi and American Express and Cadillac and American Tobacco. And oh, that alone was good for comedy. You can imagine. My mother would ask, tell me about your client. And I'm like, you know, my mother does not smoke. And this is, the, you know, she's going to think I'm like trying to talk 17-year-olds into smoking cigarettes. No. But one thing happened that I think about that I think is a really good avatar for how to do comedy right. And this happened organically. So as a big company, we had, you know, hundreds of people, and it really tense. I mean, very, very tense. And when you work in an advertising agency, you have to bill your time to the client. Mm-hmm. And we had this device called an Auditron that was hooked up to the fax machine. Yeah, we had a fax machine back in the day, and the copy machine and a lot of other things. And this one person we suspected had sent out a company-wide memo just because of how it was written. And the company-wide memo indicated that Auditrons were now being put on all the bathroom stalls. And you had to put your client's number into the thing to open up the stall. And if you stayed in there too long, the door would swing open and the paper would roll up and you would have to be, you know, on your way. Well, he would never admit to it, even to this day, would never admit to writing that memo. But it just made everybody laugh to the point where we forgot all our problems for at least a couple of days. It wasn't stand-up comedy, but it was pure comedy in the sense that it was cleverly executed. It took our own experiences of, God, we hated putting in client numbers. I mean, you spend all your day trying to remember how much you billed to this client versus that client. It was the bane of our existence, but he took the most absurd example of how it could be used and made it relatable. That's an example of what a company can do to break the ice between unnatural constituencies.
That's a good point. Yeah.
To get everybody really feeling good and laughing at the absurdity of the crazy stuff we have to do in this company.
Yep. That's a great bonding moment too. Just to acknowledge the absurdity, but then take it to the nth degree. Like, this would never happen, but, you know, let's magnify what we're already looking at and have some fun with that. That's a pretty harmless way of doing it. And again, it does bring people together and helps people forget, not forget the problems, but minimize them, make them more temporary, make them more manageable. That's a real outcome of using humor, is it makes problems seem smaller and gives that subconscious message that if we can laugh about it, we can do something about it.
So growing up, who were your favorite comedians?
I went through phases. Yeah. I think it was because I used to write parodies. I was in theater in high school. And so I would write very slapstick parodies of whatever musical we were in. So I was really into like Airplane and Monty Python growing up. Mm. And then when I started listening to stand up, I really enjoyed Mitch Hedberg's wit, his joke writing, his one-liners, the way he carried himself. And then Jim Gaffigan was another one that really,
sure,
I'll never forget watching his first special Beyond the Pale in my buddy's living room. And just, I couldn't breathe because I was laughing so hard. And then I got into sketch comedy first and like improv to kind of go back into that slapstick. I want to write scripts. But I worked at a stand-up comedy club and I started appreciating that art form more and more the longer that I worked there. And so that's where I discovered like John Mulaney and Louis C.K. and Dave Chappelle. I mean, I was aware of Chappelle, but I started appreciating the little nuances in his performance. And I started doing research on like Carlin and just the way that he would present an argument in very straightforward, yet non-threatening way, kind of like an all sides sort of mentality. And so there's a lot of comics that I draw my influences from, a lot of styles that I draw my influences from. Right now I'm doing a lot of bits based on like problems in the world, but approaching it from an exaggerated, like I have a solution to this problem and my solution is very exaggerated, just to kind of get people on the same page. Like, oh, that's a ridiculous way of looking at this. So that when they're actually thinking about the problem, they're thinking about it from a different point of view. So weed legalization, what if it were mandatory? What would that world look like? And then I have fun in that sandbox. And so there's a little bit of the absurdity from the Monty Python in there. There's a little bit of the real world application from Carlin. And then there's that kind of likability of a John Mulaney or a Jim Gaffigan in there. So I draw influences from all over the place.
Can you imagine weed legalization and if people are taking weed breaks at work?
I mean, yeah, I don't vouch for that.
Hey, I worked in an advertising agency. That would have been like a job one, have weed legalized.
Hey, yeah, you know, yeah.
So I would imagine a lot of your repertoire has to do with future of work, because in the last year, the whole concept of work, where we work, how we work, who we work with, are we in each other's physical presence, has been completely thrown up in the air and tossed around. Will the future of work be funny in your estimation?
It has to be.
Yeah.
It has to be. I mean, I'm not talking about everybody's roaring with laughter all day, every day. But I think we need to draw attention to the mistakes that we make at work. I think we need to draw attention to the fact that we don't have the answers and present that vulnerability. We don't have the answers. Like, that's the thing that's so funny, is that we try to put on this facade that we do have the answers, that I'm the one that can solve the problem. And that's dishonest. It betrays trust. And we need more trust. We need more vulnerability. We need more honesty. And being open to the fact that we're human does that. And that's, comedy is the human experience. So yes, the future of work does involve comedy. It does involve laughter. Because with more and more jobs that are going to be automated, more and more jobs that are going to be better done by AI, we have to lean into what makes us human. And what makes us human is our creative side and is our ability to connect with one another. And humor is part of both of those processes.
And I think it'll help to mitigate the fear that a lot of people have of losing a job to a robot. David Horning, you've been a great guest, and I appreciate you being on the podcast. Before we depart, I was wondering if you could point our listeners to your social media and also how they can get in touch with you if they have any questions.
Yeah, absolutely. My social media is so vastly different from one another. Twitter is where I try new jokes. Instagram, you know, I'm at the David Horning on both Twitter and Instagram. And then LinkedIn, I'm blog posts. I'm talking about the future of work. I'm talking about leadership. So you can find me on there. And then my website is watercoolercomedy.org. There's links to my podcast there. There's links to my blog, my programs, all of that. You can get a hold of me there. There's a contact page. Or you can just shoot me an email, david@watercoolercomedy.org. I'm very easy to stalk.
You're very easy to stalk.
And very easy to stalk. If I ever get a stalker, they just look at my Instagram. What shows is David doing this week? They're all there.
And we'll have all that information in the show notes for your episode. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for having me. This was fun.
Links to David Horning's social media are included in the show notes for this episode at dansmolin.com. Meantime, if you haven't done so, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get them, or listen to current and past episodes on our website at dansmolin.com. And please take a moment to positively rate and comment wherever you listen to this podcast, because that helps us to connect with new listeners. I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Dan Smolin Podcast. Thank you for joining us on an amazing journey to the future of work, doing meaningful work. And do remember this, our best days lie ahead. Let's connect again next week.